The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Jemima Kish. This week on the show...
I think overall, Microsoft is trying to go tete-a-tete with Google. You see that with the Office web apps, where they're really trying to move that in an aggressive cadence and get an experience that is much better than Google's own apps.
Charles Arthur meets Microsoft expert Wes Miller to discuss the tech giant's Herculean battle with its competitors and what's around the corner for people who use Microsoft services. Also, Apple announced the arrival of iOS 8, and we'll be deciphering the fallout from the latest rash of CryptoLocker malicious ransomware attacks. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Joining us this week are Guardian tech writers Samuel Gibbs and Alex Hearn. Welcome, welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Guardian technology editor Charles Arthur is on the ground in San Francisco, where the world's most devoted Apple developers gathered for their annual developer conference last night to reveal the next slew of software updates and announcements from Apple. Engineering chief Craig Federighi led most of the event, but first off, here's how CEO Tim Cook kicked things off.
And iOS 8 is a giant release, and it's really two stories, not one. It has great end-user features, but it also has incredible developer features, so you can extend your experience and build apps that you couldn't do before.
The results were pretty much as we expected, weren't they, Charles? Tell us what was announced and what difference this will make to the average Apple consumer.
Well, there's no hardware at all. It was all in the software. But actually, one of the really interesting things was about the way that they announced it. So you had Tim Cook, you had Craig Federighi, who's the head of software, and you had a few other sort of key Apple executives. But it was really interesting. There was a sort of swagger about them. You know, there's been so much sort of swirling around about, oh, can Apple innovate anymore? You know, just not doing anything. Last year, I think they were a little bit hesitant about what sort of effect the introduction of iOS 7, which was this radical new redesign by Jony Ive, how it would be received. And you know, a lot of people stroke their chins a lot. This time around, they have iOS 8. So everyone knows it's built on iOS 7, but they brought lots of really interesting new features in, such as being able to interact between apps, something which Android has had since forever, which people have been expecting or hoping for in Apple. But it was really the way they presented it, which was really interesting. There was a lot of sort of sniping, you would almost call it, by Tim Cook at Google and Android. Google itself, in terms of the search engine, was relegated to two mentions, I counted, through this two-hour speech. And things like Bing and Wikipedia got far more mentions. And it was very evident that there's almost a sort of... Yeah, it's almost like they just don't like each other. That if Apple could get a divorce from Google, which is pretty much done, then it would.
It's not like they almost don't like them. I mean, there is almost open warfare, isn't it?
There's certainly antipathy at the high levels of Apple towards Google. They just don't like some of the ways that Google goes about it. To some extent, it's a philosophy thing. So Apple said that, for example, in iOS 8, when it arrives in the autumn, people will be able to download third-party keyboards and use those instead of Apple's one. So Swipe and SwiftKey, people like that, will be able to provide keyboards for the iPhone and for the iPad.
Okay, so top line then. There were some interesting new features on OS X 10.10, Apple's latest version of its operating system, its desktop operating system. Give us the top line from that on what you think is really interesting.
So actually, the most interesting thing about OS X Yosemite, as it's called, is not particularly to do with the desktop. You know, when you look at the numbers, there's about 18 million users of OS X, about 4 of those are on the most recent version was last year. And you compare that to the iOS, the iPhone and iPad landscape, and you're talking hundreds of millions of people there. So the desktop's actually pretty irrelevant, almost. But what they are introducing is a thing they're calling continuity and handoff, where if your phone is plugged into to power and it's on Wi-Fi and got Bluetooth, then you'll have incoming phone calls will show up on your desktop, and also incoming SMSs. It doesn't have to be iMessage, Apple's own thing. It can be actual text messages from people from another network. And you'll be able to receive the phone calls. You'll be able to reply to the SMSs from your desktop. So Apple is sort of saying, we can integrate all these things, but you don't have to make the desktop operating system look like the mobile operating system, which is something that Microsoft has been doing, for example, with Windows 8, Windows Phone 8, and the reaction that has been from people over the way that Windows 8 has the tile interface on the top, then the old desktop interface, and the interactions that you have there. It's a really interesting play to link all these things together, to tie the desktop and the mobile worlds together, and yet keep them separate in the way that you interact with them.
Now, Sam, there were several design features on Yosemite that feel a lot more like iOS. Tell us what is in iOS 8 that excited you last night.
See, iOS 8 was kind of like a refinement of the operating system, but they launched a few really quite exciting things. For me, it was the introduction of Home, which is Apple's play into the smart home market, and really what they're doing here is providing one interface for all the connected devices around your home. So, for instance, your garage door opener, your lights, and all that kind of home automation stuff.
Washing machine is a place machine, for the data from the talking washing machine. Is that right?
It is, and all in one place with one switch. So, the most exciting thing actually was you could group these things into little like groups of devices and scenarios. So you could have one saying like, I want to go to bed, and it would dim the lights, lock the doors and things like that. But then you could actually integrate it with Siri, so you could actually ask Siri, I want to go to bed, and then it'll lock everything up and off you go to bed and not have to worry about your house. That was a really slick idea, and of course it's still an idea at the moment, because this is WWDC, this is all about developers, so they've created the underlying architecture for it, and now the individual products have to link in with the protocol.
They've kind of created the shelves, and the products to fill the shelves will come later.
Hopefully come soon, yeah.
The most widely anticipated thing, I think it's easy to say, is what we now know as Health, which is an app to aggregate fitness and health data from all of those devices that Samuel has dozens of up each arm. Tell us what was released and how much we knew about that before. Is it what we expected?
So Health, which was previously called Healthbook, but it's just Health.
Yeah, it was maybe a bad guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Passbook, Healthbook, you know, it kind of made sense from the outside before we knew anything. But Health is essentially a bit like Home in the fact that it's a place to aggregate everything and connect everything. So there are lots and lots of things that plug into Apple's iPhone. Like, I think fitness trackers, for instance, like Fitbit. But beyond that, we've got medical devices that have been using kind of like the interface that Apple introduced last year and the year before that enabled data sharing and plugging into the operating system. Now, Health effectively represents one place where you can aggregate all your data into one easy to view and crucially send the data off. So one of the examples they demonstrated on stage was, you know, you have your iPhone hooked up to a heart rate monitor, and it would be every now and again it would take readings, but then when the readings dipped below a certain threshold, it then sent a message to your doctor, and the doctor would go, oh god, maybe we should do something about this, and then could then immediately ring the person. Now, of course, all this is hypothetical at the moment because it's not fully integrated. They do have partners, of which in the UK it's very limited. It's only Cambridge University Hospitals. But it has a lot of promise.
Alex, it does have a lot of promise. It also opens an enormous gaping chasm of philosophical and ethical questions about whether we trust companies like Apple with our health data.
I think trust is a big one. And actually, you know, Apple, of all of the big tech firms is possibly in the best position, because they've consistently made clear that they're a company who is interested in making money the old-fashioned way, building things that they will sell to you for exorbitant prices and pocketing a massive, massive margin. That's actually, you know, it stings when you pay £600 out of pocket for the latest iPad, but at the same time, it's a much more comforting business model for a company which you're handing health data to than a company which makes money by mining data and selling you targeted ads.
That's some comfort, I suppose.
Some comfort indeed. But I think, I mean, the other ethical considerations that are going to start coming out of apps like Health and toolkits like HealthKit, which is the back end to all of this, is how much we want simple data about our life to affect things like insurance premiums in America, to affect how a doctor, you know, to have a doctor treating you as unwell before you even come in based on your Nike fuel band data showing that you're not moving enough, that raises its own set of questions. And this information can be used well or badly.
I think this is something we're going to have to return to in great depth and very frequently. One last point, Alex. There were a lot of winners and losers in Apple's speech, certainly in the opening 20 minutes. Twitter was awash with people observing which companies and services were being disrupted by what Apple had introduced.
I mean, with these events, there is always the case that some companies see their business model going down the plan, that going down the plug hole. It's even got a name. It's Sherlocked, after way back when Apple introduced its Sherlock search tool, which completely obliterated the need for a third-party program called Watson, which did basically the same thing. This time has been no different. So you can see, for instance, iMessage, some of the changes made in iMessage that let you send photo and video messages that time out, that's clearly targeting Snapchat. You can change the name of group chats and leave them, that's lifting features straight from WhatsApp. You can now use iCloud Drive in a way that previously you'd needed to install Dropbox on. These are the losers. One of the big differences for this is there are very clear winners as well. Because this is the developer conference, a lot of what was shown is Apple making new hooks into the operating system that will let developers do things they couldn't do before. The thing is, a lot of the time, right now, what those hooks let you do is things that Android can already do. Developers like SwiftKey, who make third-party keyboards, developers who make apps that need this flexibility, suddenly have a whole new park to play in.
Charles, what do you think is the single most significant part of the announcement last night?
I think actually the single most significant is the announcement of extensibility, this thing that is like what Android and Windows Phone have, where different apps can communicate between each other, they can pass data between each other. So, for example, if you want to do a filter on a photo, you don't have to be looking at the photo, go to Instagram, apply the filter, go back to the thing, then post it on Twitter. You can just be in the photos, apply a filter from Instagram, send it up onto whatever social networks while you're in the same place. And I think that that's going to make a huge difference, and that a lot of the developers will love that. And I think that that's a win for the developers, but it's also a win for Apple in terms of the convenience. I think people will really like the convenience of that. And sorry, and the other thing that I think, I mean, it's not a thing that was announced, but the mood music from Apple is that they're not against the idea of larger phone screens, you know, that that could be coming. And I think that if you combine those sorts of things with better interaction between apps, and things like iCloud Drive, which means that all the sort of writing apps, the document creation, content creation apps, can be more explicit for people who want to work in file systems, then I think those are really big wins for Apple in terms of trying to tempt people either away from Android altogether or just keep Apple users within its ecosystem.
And Alex, what was the most significant thing for you?
Judging from all the reports in the room, when Apple was talking about its new programming language, Swift, there was a complete divide. The media sat there stony-faced, wondering why they were having to sit through 10 minutes of coding talk, and the developers were going wild. And, you know, I have an incredibly passing knowledge of coding, but even I could see that what Apple was showing there was an extraordinarily easy-to-use programming language that should make coding for iOS and Mac a breeze, and then make the programs that are written using it actually hundreds of times faster. As that starts paying off, we could just, as users, be seeing faster apps written in no time. It'll be nice.
And there is, of course, a slew of Apple-related coverage on our website. Just go to theguardian.com/tech. CryptoLocker is a particularly ugly piece of malicious software that allows criminals to take some of your PC's files hostage and then makes you pay a ransom to get them back. This week, we saw a major crackdown on this internet fiend. Alex is going to explain to us what happened this week, and we'll also be joined on the line by Tom Brewster, who writes on tech security for The Guardian and other august publications. Welcome, Tom.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Okay, so let's start at the top then. GoZeus and CryptoLocker, what are they? What do they do, and why are they a problem?
Yeah, so, well, GoZeus is essentially a massive botnet, a very complex one. It essentially uses peer-to-peer communication, which means that there aren't really any central points of control for the attackers to use. On its own, it simply steals banking login credentials. But it also happens to be used by these alleged Russian criminals for dropping CryptoLocker, which itself is a really nasty piece of work. It'll be chucked on your machine. It'll then encrypt all of your files with high-level encryption. The attacker will then come and say, I will decrypt these with my private key if you give me a certain amount of money, which was one Bitcoin at one point. And there is essentially no other way to decrypt those files once that's happened. And that's what makes it particularly nasty. It's affecting quite a lot of people. I'm pretty sure it was around 15,500 for GoZeus in the UK and about 500,000 to a million globally. And then for CryptoLocker, it was 234,000 or more. And then I think the figures for the UK are quite low, sort of 5,000 to 10,000.
It sounds like some kind of evil genius, though. I mean, it's taking encryption, which is obviously mm-hmm. designed to protect people's information, and then turning it against them, which is brilliant, mm-hmm. isn't it? But how long has this technique been around?
Quite a while, actually, but not to this degree. So ransomware has been around for a very long time. It usually essentially just stops you getting at the files. That usually comes in the form of police ransomware, where a message will come up and say, you can't access your machine because we think you've been doing dodgy stuff on it, so you need to pay us a fine. And obviously that's all fake.
It is fake, but probably there are some people who have been doing slightly dodgy stuff online, whether that's porn or downloading illegal music, and maybe they would feel, you know, that there's an emotional trigger in there, which is very clever, isn't it? And this is a classic scammer's technique.
Yeah, definitely. It's social engineering that's kind of been ramped up to a whole new level. But attackers across the board have been doing that, kind of coming up with new ways to make people pay. A lot of people are doing illegal downloads, obviously. I imagine a lot of people are using pornography, but I wouldn't know about that.
Well, of course.
And so they think it is a genuine fine that they need to pay when it isn't.
It's very unusual to have such a high profile story, perhaps unfortunately, about cyber security though. Why have Interpol and the FBI and the National Crime Bureau been so enthused about this?
Well, this is an odd one because on one side it is particularly impressive. In terms of the technical operation, it's very impressive because they've taken down a peer-to-peer botnet, which is much harder than taking down a standard botnet, which will use very centralized points of control. So you can go after those centralized points of control and shut them down. So it's very impressive that they've managed to do this. And from what I've seen, they've actually managed to subvert one of the sort of backup communication methods used by the CryptoLocker guys. And it's very, very smart. I'm pretty sure there's a company called Dambala, and then it's Georgia Tech as well, who have been pretty heavily involved in that. So from that side, it's incredibly impressive because it's a big kind of technical feat. But then on the other side, they haven't caught anyone. and before, with any kind of botnet takedown, we've always seen botnets come back, largely because there haven't been any arrests. And what's going to happen now, and you'll see it over the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks, is essentially the guys running this operation will simply change the code in that malware, they'll use services called crypting, which essentially when you pay someone to change the code in your malware so antivirus can't detect it, and then they'll start chucking that at people's machines. So not only does it mean that the new crypto locker versions are going to be more successful because the AV won't stop them, it means the attackers now have an opportunity to kind of rethink what they're doing and revamp the whole process and probably make it even harder to detect than it already was. So it's a kind of it's a double-edged sword here. You know, you've got a very smart takedown, but then you've got no arrest, which essentially means they will be back very, very soon.
The two-week deadline was one of the highest profile elements of this story, but that's only a guess, isn't it, really, of how long it will take the scammers to get the malware back online and back infecting people's machines again.
Exactly. It's an estimate. I would love to know what they've based that estimate on. I personally think they've actually probably gone a bit earlier. So I don't think they'll be back that quickly. I would suggest 2 weeks is probably the National Crime Agency's way of saying, look, you should probably move quickly. When I spoke to the head of the Europol operation, he essentially thinks it's going to be down for a very long time. He doesn't give any specific time frame. But yeah, these guys will be back soon, and that's why the NCA is trying to encourage people to move as fast as they can.
Tom, what's your one piece of essential advice for anyone who's concerned about the security of their machines and is concerned about Crypto Locker specifically? Where do they need to go and what do they need to do?
They need to back up. I think that's the first thing. If you've got a backup of every single file on your machine, it doesn't really matter that Crypto Locker has locked you out. I think that has to be the first port of call. And then obviously get a decent antivirus that will at least have some chance of blocking some malware getting on your machine. I think those two are really the only two bits of technology you can use. And then just, do not open emails. Do not follow links on social media that look dodgy. Be, act like you would in the normal world, but on your computer, don't trust people that you don't think deserve trust.
Don't talk to strangers.
Exactly, yeah.
Tom, that was really interesting and very, very useful stuff. So take care out there.
Thanks very much.
Thanks. Thank you to Charles in San Francisco and to Alex and Samuel, and also to Tom Brewster for advice on malware attacks. And of course, for the latest news day or night, just go to theguardian.com/technology. Apple's tie-in with Bing's search engine is a sign of how both companies feel the need to battle the dominance of Google in this area. But what more can Microsoft do to take on its competitors? Guardian technology editor Charles Arthur met up with Wes Miller of IT planning service Directions on Microsoft to get an expert opinion on where this tech giant is going.
So I'm here with Wes Miller of Directions on Microsoft, which is, well, Wes, describe what it is.
Sure. We're an analyst firm based out of Kirkland, Washington, just a little bit away from Microsoft. And for 20 years, our company has sort of focused on the so what, if you will, of Microsoft, really helping their enterprise customers, their partners, and sometimes even Microsoft understand what's going on with their technology.
So you produce a subscription newsletter. It's actually on print. It doesn't go out in a PDF or any other sort of form? It's
not in a PDF. We're actually classic paper in most of the cases. And a lot of people really enjoy taking it with them while they're traveling on business travel and reading it. We do have it available online as well, but we do a lot of print.
And you used to work yourself at Microsoft, so you know what it's like inside the belly of the beast. You worked on XP, as I understand it.
Right. So I was there from 1997 to 2004, and XP and Windows Server 2003 are the things I have Ship It awards for, and worked in the setup and deployment team. So I joined a bunch of other ex-Microsoft colleagues. There's a few who aren't, but most are ex-Microsoft at Directions.
So you've been over here in London doing what you call the boot camps, where you're actually meeting people who are your subscribers, people who want to know what is Microsoft up to, and where's it going. What is Microsoft up to? I mean, give us a picture, because Steve Ballmer has left. It's now Satya Nadella as the chief executive. There's been a reorganization, which Steve Ballmer started, to make the structure more horizontal, so that rather than having separate divisions, each doing their own sales and marketing development, development. You'd have a sort of sales and marketing efforts which would go across the company from the Azure cloud services through to Xbox. How is Microsoft coping with these changes, and what sort of direction is Microsoft going in?
Sure. Yeah, I was here for one of our licensing boot camps, and I did another one in New York last week, and it gives me a unique opportunity to talk to customers about where Microsoft is headed. And a lot of what you're saying is what the large customers that I talk to are sort of feeling. And sometimes that's good, sometimes it's bad. They're excited about, you know, new versions of SharePoint and Exchange coming out as early as next year. They're not excited about not knowing what's coming beyond that, for example. But I think to your question of how the org changes are affecting Microsoft, a lot of what we see today, I think, are really the ricochets off of actions that Steve performed while he was still CEO. And it's going to take another 12 months or so before we really start seeing things that Satya has put into action affecting the output of the company. It just takes a little bit more time. But overall, we're definitely seeing a different dynamic, a different sort of cadence of when deliveries happen and how often they happen. So both the cadence and the rhythm are increasing.
So Satya Nadella came from the sort of cloud side. Is there a shift in Microsoft towards a strategy which is more cloud-based, or is there less emphasis on the enterprise, more on the consumer now that they own the Nokia handset business? How is the dynamic changing there?
Well, I think what we're really seeing is the beginning of what they've promised for the last year and a half, at least, of the services and devices mantra. You know, Microsoft originally started with that vision of a computer on every desk and every home, et cetera, which was really about the OS and about consumers more than anything else, or being that machine that you could do multi-plan on. And as you look at where they are right now, it is really shifting, as you noted, with the services back end, which is both client and server. So you see an analog of many of the consumer technologies, such as OneDrive, Outlook.com, and Skype, in the enterprise services when you look at Exchange Online, SharePoint Online, and Link Online. So you see the two services. And I think the big question right now is how those wind up being harmonized, both so consumers, enterprise, or, you know, home users can actually understand what the technology stack is that's there, what I get out of it, how much I'm paying, and what's the difference from the thing I get, and point to the other environment, whether they're at home or at work. So I think there's a lot of marketing work that probably needs to happen more than anything else, and really trying to integrate these technologies into a cohesive set of technologies that make sense, whether you're at home or at work.
So just to jump back a little bit, this idea of Microsoft as a services and devices company, it always has made its money and still does make its money from software, doesn't it? You know, it makes it from licensing Windows, licensing Office, licensing, you know, SharePoint, Exchange. It's a software company. How can the thing about services and devices fit with that?
That's a really great question. And I think when we look at it, there's Microsoft today and there's Microsoft where they want to be tomorrow. And again, where they had the mantra classically on the desktop and they want to move to this services world, I think that they've got a little bit of work to do to help everybody understand how they're going to get there. Because you're right, the enterprise is where they make that money. I mean, when we do these boot camps, we do them to help customers understand how to navigate these complex licensing rules, how to stay above board and not get into trouble, because reviews and audits do actually happen. So we're trying to help them understand how to do the right thing in what can be pretty complex and increasingly costly rules. And Microsoft has to help these kind of customers navigate to a world where they're using subscription-based software instead of these classic licenses. So there's a lot of shifting sands, and it's going to be really interesting to see the company navigate it over the next 3 to 5 to 10 years.
We were talking a little earlier before we came recording this, and you were saying that the Build conference that Microsoft held over the past 4 years, you've seen a shift in their approach to how they're sort of approaching people. That 4 years ago with Steve Sinofsky, with the impending release then of Windows 8, it was very much telling people what they were going to get. And now the sort of feeling has softened a bit. How has that changed exactly?
Well, I think when we look back, I've been to every Build except for the one last year in San Francisco, and the tenor of all of them that I've gone to has gotten a little bit, I don't want to say softer, because they have a very distinct message that they're trying to deliver, but maybe less hard. When you looked at that first Build that happened back in Anaheim, the message was very singular in focus. It was, we have built this, you'll like it. And it wasn't asking a question. It was really saying, you'll like it. And I'm not sure that they had engaged well enough to find out whether people in the end would like it. And most notably, their partners didn't feel like they were a part of that conversation at all. It was Microsoft, the Windows team, and Microsoft, the Surface team, were talking to each other. But the partners had really felt kind of left out.
The OEM, the people who make the computers. You
know? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen several partners, we can talk about this in a second, come around on the other side and say, well, all right, we're gonna make some interesting things out of this, like Lenovo. But Microsoft in particular, if we go to this last build, there was a phrase that I heard repeated several times, and you had to listen for it, but it was out there, which was, it's a journey, which was, I felt, a gentleman's way of saying, we think we've done a good job. We hope you like it. It was very different from, we've built this and you will like it.
It's a journey is a phrase that I would sort of associate either with X Factor, you know, contestants who are hoping to get to the happy singy final, or else Game of Thrones, where they always seem to be wandering about the countryside, getting heads lopped off and stuff, and trying to reach some sort of happy endpoint, but not often succeeding. I mean, which of those two scenarios are we talking about here?
Well, I think we're talking about a journey in which Microsoft is not saying, it's not quite as bad as the Game of Thrones aspect, but I think what they're trying to do is make sure that they don't meet any sort of strange demise because they didn't listen to what customers wanted. And again, remember, as we were talking about, it's those enterprise customers who pay the bills to keep the lights on. And a lot of them aren't ready for touch-based desktops, and a lot of them aren't ready to retrain their users. And it may sound petty to say that, but that's not free to do. And to replace all those desktops with touch or to retrain users of how to navigate, it's nonsensical. So I think that where they're headed in adding back the start menu and adding windowed Metro apps so that tablet users will have a great experience on tablets and desktop users with mice will have, or touchpads, will have a great experience on their devices, it will lend them the ability to serve two masters a lot better than that original headstrong vision was able to or not able to.
And how, sort of more generally, how do you think Microsoft now sits vis-a-vis Apple and Google, which are generally seen as its principal competitors? I mean, is it a sort of a frenemy, you know, if you like, a sort of friend and an enemy with Apple? It seems very much not to like Google in most of the public actions that one sees. How would you sort of, you know, class its relationship with them and again, the sort of the dynamic, the direction that it's going in terms of, is it getting closer to Apple, further away, closer to Google, further away? How is it going there?
I think in general, Microsoft is getting a little bit further away from Apple. For example, ActiveSync is the one thing that we can see that sort of literally does link the two companies. It lets you connect your iOS device or your Mac to an Exchange server. So it's really what lets you have business class email on an Apple-branded device or many other non-Microsoft devices. So that's one key thing. And really the only other bonding aspect that holds Apple and Microsoft together is the existence of Microsoft apps on Apple platforms, the best example of that being, of course, Mac, Office for the Mac, which is 2011, and we expect another version later this year, and then Office for the iPad, which just arrived but is chemically bonded to an Office 365 subscription. Mm-hmm. So I think Microsoft is very interested in saying, if my competitor, which I think they firmly view Apple as, they should, if my competitor is doing better in devices than I am, I should be making sure that my services are first class in that world. And with Google, it's sort of the opposite. There's two aspects that I think are interesting there. There's definitely no love lost between the two companies. We saw the whole Scroogled campaign, for an example, which I'm not a big fan of. And I think overall, Microsoft is trying to go tete-a-tete with Google. You see that with the Office web apps, where they're, again, really trying to move that in an aggressive cadence and get an experience that is much better than Google's own apps. And, oh, yeah, we have a full desktop suite if you want that too. And then conversely, as Nokia really begins to develop these odd Linux-based or Android-based phones, people sit there and scratch their heads. But I think we're looking at an interesting subversion tactic to try and build an Android-based ecosystem that connects perfectly into Microsoft's own services. So again, it's about the services, not really about the software anymore.
So if we sort of fast forward 5 years, how do you think Microsoft will be looking? I mean, people have been talking about Microsoft as irrelevant. They don't sort of look to it for big changes in software. They, you know, it's not like the 1990s when Microsoft basically drove the whole computing industry in front of it. And the directions that it took were the directions which decided where, you know, where you would be. You know, how do you think its importance will look in, you know, in the next few years, and can it regain that relevance if it actually has lost it?
It's a really interesting thing to think about. I left in 2004, and that was not long after Longhorn, as I like to say, had gone off the rails.
Longhorn, which became Windows Vista.
It's not my fault, as I like to say. you know, the product had really... Microsoft had lost its mojo, in my opinion. And I think from a Windows perspective, the team picked up what it's what it had lost and really did a pretty amazing job with Windows 7. But again, I think a lot of teams had sort of fallen down a little bit, and there just wasn't the excitement. Frankly, as a tech guy, I was kind of bored for a little while. The industry just seemed to slow down. Apple was sort of slowing down. And I think the introduction of the iPhone and then the iPad and Google and Apple going tête-à-tête with that really forced Microsoft's hand and, again, forced them to rethink how they're going to make money and exist in the future. So will Microsoft be really different in 5 or 10 years? I think absolutely. It's going to be very different. And if you showed it to someone from 5 years ago, this is what Microsoft will look like 10 years from now, They'd say you're absolutely crazy. But the company is in the middle of a transformation. And you know, I wish them the best of luck. It's going to be an interesting journey. But I think that it's very doable. They're definitely going to dedicate the resources to try and shift everything towards this services, in my opinion, services first world. And the devices, those are proving to be a little bit more of a challenge. But I think the services are one aspect that they can definitely head towards.
Wes Miller from Directions on Microsoft, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For a link to Wes Miller's site, just go to the blog for this podcast at theguardian.com/techweekly. And that's all we have time for you on this week's pod. Alex Kratosky will be back next week. But from me, Jemima Kish, all the tech team, and producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.